AI may have really important value for you. You have to determine whether it does.
Your role as a human becomes managing them.
Yes, I'm writing about complexity, and Columbia University will be publishing the book.
Maybe what's happening is that companies are not hiring chief marketing officers who can actually do the job.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Marketing Podcast. With me is Doug Garnett, as usual. Doug, how are you? It's been a while.
Well, I'm doing well. I'm bunkered down up here in the Portland, Oregon.
It's lovely.
It's lovely, and it's fall, and so it's been quite pretty.
Yes, yes. I also want to remind all of us that this podcast is shaping up to be the Marketing is Everything podcast, referencing both the article by Regis McKenna in Harvard Business Review 30 years ago, but also how our conversations have been just evolving. So the cartoon of the week, well, the episode, is related to AI. So why don't you tee it up, please?
All right. I know it's a shocker that we're going to cover AI, but
yes, we might nobody else does.
I know. Somebody I love going back to these old topics that nobody ever talks about. So we return to the marketoonist today, whose cartoon has a whole bunch of gophers popping out of the hole. And he says, it's hard to get any work done with all of these alerts trying to help me get my work done. And the alerts are saying things like, try AI now, generate document. How about now? Summarize this page. Let me help you. And he's obviously having to try to beat the squirrels away.
The whack-a-mole is definitely there.
And there is.
Yep. I just don't understand why they do that, because It must work for them, I imagine.
I don't know if it works for them. I think, you know, the truth is it is a marketing issue. If, you know, like Microsoft, if they add AI to Microsoft Word, they need to habituate people to use it if they're going to ever have it be a significant advantage for them. So I suppose they would justify that by as a way to habituate people. Like, hey, did you think about using AI now? Hey, did you think about using AI now? As a user, it sucks. You know, I mean, I'm assuming that that's what their theory is. And, you know, there's very often theory and reality don't seem to quite meet.
Right, right. So speaking of AI and the complexity and All of these topics are like touch everything. There was something else funny happened when there was a non-trivial AWS Amazon Web Services outage.
Well, we are, I suppose I should note, we are recording on Halloween. And for those who follow AWS should know that last week, a week ago on Monday, there was an AWS outage. And of course, we all bitched about it because every one of us had a favorite service go down. Some people got to bitch even more, though, because they owned smart beds. And 2,000 or more smart beds got stuck in an inclined position and an overheating mode due to the AWS outage. While each bed cost $5,000, it also has the annual subscription of $400.
Wow.
So next time you go out to buy that $5,000 connected bed, remember the AWS outage.
Well, drawing from our collective IT experience of the past, there was a time when everything ran on mainframes. And mainframes are designed to be highly reliable, never go down. But if they did go down, it was catastrophic and it was a career event. And as we morphed from mainframe world to the cloud world, the cloud is now kind of the new mainframe.
Well, really,
so
it
isn't supposed to go down, but when it does, it's kind of pretty damaging.
Yeah, isn't the cloud theory, and you know much more about this than I do, but the cloud theory is you've got all these different computers that it's on, and therefore it should be highly resilient. But we know from experience that AWS goes down probably, twice a year? They have a major problem with it?
Well, I mean, we were talking about it earlier about the difference between robustness and resilience and availability and reliability, serviceability. So there's a whole classes of failures that they manage without anybody noticing. So if there ever is an outage like there was, when it becomes notable, it's either something that is really highly unlikely to happen and it happened and now everybody learns their lesson, or like a half a dozen things go wrong at the same time, which is also really unlikely. So these systems are that resilient and it should be good. But on top of that, you have to write your application in a resilient way. And if you didn't do that, then you're exposed. Some people had it written like that. So one zone fails, it fails over to another zone and you maybe hiccup and then you carry on.
Is there a way to look at it almost statistically, which is, I mean, Amazon is getting rid of the single point failures, right? Because it happens, they go, well, we'll make sure that doesn't happen again.
Right.
On the other hand, when you have so many things in operation at once, you know, the idea that 6 to 10 of them will cluster into a failure is inevitable in some ways. And I also wonder to what degree that can be actually prevented, as opposed to what you suggest, which is the users then have to become smart for building workarounds, knowing that there is an inevitable case where 10 things will collude at once and they'll have a failure.
You're right that it is statistical at the end of the day, but there's a lot you can do to contain it. There's a lot you can do because the failures aren't linear and they don't just all multiply together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can't say that it's a million units and each one has a 999% and I multiply it all and therefore it's down half the time.
Now I know what my statistics are.
Yeah. Right. You can do a lot to make it work quite well. Mm-hmm. So when it does happen, it really is an aberration, but it's also a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And I think to some degree, I guess I'm just, from my own thinking, I expect that there will always be aberrations of some type.
Yes.
And so in a way, we're better off to manage business saying, look, there will be aberrations. It's the old idea that when an executive sets out a program for zero defects, it just destroys employee morale because zero defects is not a realistic, you know, target. What you have to figure out is how do you manage knowing there will be some. And so it may be cost effective to get to 97%, you know, defect free. And then you have to create a program for what do I do in the other 3%? Or how do I find them? Or how do I detect it? Or, you know, what do I do?
I think as usual, it really depends on where you're coming from and who your audience is and what sort of culture you have. I think if the idea is, hey, let's just work on building better stuff and let's come up with a mantra that says zero defect while we all know that that's an aspirational, that's fine. If you start measuring and punishing people because there is, you know, then that may be counterproductive. Anything can be done badly. But AI is going to help us, right?
Oh, that's it. AI is going to help us. Well, actually, we have an AI kerfuffle this week that we'll discuss, which is a day or two ago, Amazon made an announcement that got interpreted as Amazon, who made $35 billion in profit this year, is going to fire 14,000 workers to 30,000, somewhere in that range. And it was blamed on AI. I made comments about that. But actually, Andy Jassy came out and made what I find to be a quite confusing discussion that no, it's a layoff due to culture, which I'm still struggling with and don't quite comprehend. But he says it's not AI. So whether it's AI or not, should we talk about AI?
We should talk about AI. And by the way, I kind of bought his explanation, believe maybe more than you did, because
you did.
I thought that it was a well-crafted response and do get that some cultures do want to be lean. And the way to be lean is to just be lean. And of course, they've got a lot of employees. So 14,000 is a very small fraction. And I don't know where they're cutting. He also said, by the way, when he was asked about AI, if I remember correctly, he was saying that AI will impact everything. And it requires agility to take advantage of or to figure out how to implement it properly. And in a way, it was like another reason why being lean is a good thing.
Maybe the thing that concerned me a little bit is AI comment in the response was he said, oh, yeah, this wasn't about AI, but employees better be ready to, quote, get on board. And that comes across to me as a threat. And I would suspect a lot of employees see it as a threat. And so, you know, that sounds a little, that's part of why I wasn't so happy with his response, is I think that there is a bit about, oh, no, it's not really about AI, but boy, people better get on board or they're going to lose their job being the implied threat there. So.
Well, we should then, this is a good time to just focus on AI specifically, not Amazon, because as we were talking in our pre-call, I think that AI is impacting individuals, companies, and societies / governments. And it seems to me that every one of them comes to the conclusion that I better get busy learning what it is and using it, or I'm going to fall behind.
Yeah, and I think in our discussion, I actually have no question that AI is arriving and is going to cause lots of big changes. When it comes to, let's start with individuals. When it comes to an individual, I'm less clear that every individual needs to figure out how to use AI themselves. I think individuals in certain areas really better get their, you know, get on top of it, because it does affect those areas. But I have lived through so many tech revolutions and have watched all of the threat of you better do this or else. The one I laugh about the most was how right around 2000, companies were all told, if you don't stake out your territory online, you'll never have territory online. And that turned out to be just complete bunk. You know, really at that time, the key principle should have been online may have really great value for you if it does, go pursue it. And you should also be looking into it to determine whether it has great value for you. And that would have been smart operation at the time. And honestly, I kind of see that with AI here, which is AI may have really important value for you. You have to determine whether it does. But it's hard to tell in this world of overstatement and hype and extremes of it's all horrible or all great.
Well, this raises the complexity topic, mm-hmm. which everybody should know if they don't already, that you're writing a book on complexity and mm-hmm. you have a publisher now and you've been working on it for a very long time. So it's really an excellent work. I believe the complexity here is that as an individual or a company or a government, you don't know. If you do it, it could be harmful. If you don't do it, it could be harmful. Mm-hmm. If you don't know how to do it and you do it, it is definitely harmful. And then it's not just this one thing. You could like work months on AI only to realize that it was cryptocurrencies you should have been working on, right?
Well, and actually, even within AI, I mean, AI is not one thing, right? I mean, AI is a bunch of different things. You've got, you know, a lot of different ways it could be envisioned to be used, and you could go pursue the one that everybody says is best. Maybe, you know, AI, we're replace all of our customer service agents with AI, and you may discover that that actually didn't really matter, and you really should have been pursuing AI in programming. I don't know. I'm just pulling those out of my hat, but even AI is not really a monolithic thing. It's a lot of possible things. Mm-hmm. And I think in a way, that's maybe the challenge for it. I was particularly dismayed on one of the Retail Wire posts. It's not Retail Wire is great. Within the post, though, there was a whole bunch of discussion about the most important topic in the C-suite of every retailer right now is AI. And I thought, those are retailers destined for the dustbin. Because if that's their most important topic, their eye is way off the ball. Because AI is an important topic. But my God, retail lives and dies on whether the stores are meaningful to people. And stores have serious problems right now. There's a lot of real estate change going on, mall changes, what should be stocked, how do you stock it? There's so many changes going on that if they're focused on AI, their eye is not where it should be.
And I tell you, just the processes within the store.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that's where they all fall. And that may also be, by the way, where they could use technology in a proper way. Mm-hmm. How the person attending to customers can interact with the back end.
Right.
With mm-hmm. the inventory, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that those are the things. So, you know, yeah, that's what they should be, you know.
So that's also part of the complexity is like, what is it good for? Where do I use it?
Yep. Yeah. And we don't know that. There's a lot unknown, you know, for all the pressured hype about AI. We really have a lot we don't know yet. Fortunately, what we can say probably about it is, whereas Facebook, now Meta, came out and told us the metaverse was going to be the future of everything, but didn't really focus on use cases. At least within AI, we know there are use cases that matter. And I think metaverse right now seems stagnant because I'm not seeing much about useful use cases, although I'm sure there are some out there. But AI, yeah, there clearly are use cases. The question is, for you, where does it matter?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we talked about this when Apple came up with their goggle, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. still is there, but not mm-hmm. getting as much airtime as it did before. Mm-hmm. I think there's potential there that will materialize when the time is right. But yeah, it's an example of trying to get it right and having to go through a period before that emerges. The other thing I want to mention on AI is what I consider to be an important but not entirely relevant discussion of whether AI is real intelligence or not. Mm-hmm. Because I do see AI as fundamentally about more sophisticated automation. Mm-hmm. And if it can do something, if it can automate something, including automate things that may be cognitive, then you can automate that. And if you use it, then you use it like that. So whether or not it is intelligence becomes academically interesting to me, and maybe even fundamentally more interesting than that. But right now, it's not, in my opinion, that relevant.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I think actually, I mean, my sense is they would use issue to generate a lot of hype because it makes great newspaper articles in The Atlantic and stuff. But in reality, I don't care. I mean, I think my own assumption is it might end up reflecting certain kinds of intelligence that some humans have. It is not humanly intelligent. And actually, as I was explaining earlier for the complexity world, we actually can't really define what human intelligence means. There are right. So many flavors and accents and directions and elements and parts of human intelligence. And each of us has a different share of those. Each of us has unique intelligences that are ours. There is no general intelligence possible because we don't even know what general intelligence is. You can't describe it.
And what we have is different for different people and different things and different times, right?
Yeah, I mean, you and I talked at length about, you know, back in the, I suppose, this was called, go back then, there was a period of time when people would say, well, chess is the ultimate, you know, human intelligent activity. And, you know, by 2000, we realized that a computer can play chess pretty damn well. And, you know, so it's not that it wasn't human intelligence, but it's a specific type of intelligence that was useful in chess. And then computers became able to do that.
And chess, of course, you know, in retrospect, if not in prospect, the rules are known. It's a confined area. Mm-hmm. It was really down to how many moves ahead could you analyze? Do you have a so-called economic evaluation of whether this move is better than another move? And it was really just a matter of computational power to be able to do it. And eventually you had that much computational power. You could say that's the same thing with deep learning. Neural nets were known since the 50s.
Right.
1950s. Right. And it just couldn't be done because the computational power wasn't there until really like about a decade ago when it became possible to use GPUs to make them tractable. And then the rest is history. So whenever there's a large body of data and the rules of engagement are well known, on top of that, it's okay to be potentially wrong, then you have a use case here. I think we see that right now.
I think back to complexity a bit, I think that the idea of it being within bounds, right? I mean, there's a lot of discussion that goes on in business about, well, we know this or we know that. But what is really rarely discussed is how much the narrow bounds are required to make that happen. I mean, one of the truths in science, in fact, is that to discover laws in science, scientists have to establish pretty strict boundaries around those situations. So Newton, even for Newton's law, he had to assume, I'm not going to worry about this, I'm not going to worry about that. If I just look at this little bit, I've got a law. Well, that doesn't mean it's the ultimate law for everything. It means it fits within that. Mm-hmm. As science progressed, people started becoming more and more narrow, and the laws past Newton, some of them became pretty freaking obscure, you know, to where you're like, really? Do we even care to know that as a law? And yes, social scientists, I'm calling you out. There's a lot of social science, which is, well, within this narrow circumstance, we discover this, but then their headline says, this is always true.
You know? Yes.
So narrowness is critical within a lot of things. The true complexity of doing business is we don't have that narrowness. You know, we're working within a whole world that, you know, we have some narrowness on market and assumptions, but we're working within a whole world. And there are things that can come at us that are from outside of the narrow range of our vision, such as a pandemic, you know.
Excellent example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't, you know, in 2019, I wasn't thinking, oh, there'll be a worldwide pandemic next year. Mm-mm, you know, you can't predict that. It just comes and you have to figure out what you're going to do. In response to
Well, you know, you could be better prepared for it. Well, and hopefully we would be next time. But yeah, I agree. It's like there are things that are completely, if not a complete black swan, some shade of gray swan.
Well, I think it's just simply unexpected. I think to me, some of what we should learn from the last pandemic was that best practices need to be treated with a little bit of care, a little bit more care. Because when the pandemic arrived, the epidemiologists all went to their best practice books, but some stuff didn't matter for this specific pandemic. And this gets back to the complexity we were talking about earlier with, okay, how do you make choices? Well, in reality, there are no universal paths to business success. All paths to business success depend on you, on where you are, on your employees, on your company, on your market, on what your company does, you know, all those things. And so, and that's kind of challenging because we've been in a business environment where there's been all kinds of headlines about, you know, well, this is the way to use advertising for success, or this is the way to succeed online. But the ways to succeed online are limitless, you know. It all depends on you and your situation and how do you create strength for it. And I guess that comes back for me to AI. But that is the truth in AI, is there are no universal paths to success with AI. It all depends on you and your company. Where could you find a place that AI makes sense and you know, does something significant for you?
But how do you go about figuring that out, right?
Well, I mean, for me, that's the fun. So I know that that's not the fun for everybody. But for me, that's the fun. Because the question is, how do you understand your business's strengths, weaknesses, ideas, limits, opportunities in a way to identify where could you go? From here. Some businesses, you know, I've faced this at times, you know, you look at it and you realize there actually aren't any major advantages laying out there. And actually, in that case, AI or not, you're not necessarily going to make progress. If there aren't major advantages sitting there for higher revenue, new markets, better profits, it's not out there. I think the thing that you and I talked about that worried me most out of Andy Jassy's response was that his response labeled AI fundamentally as all about cost efficiencies. And that bothers me because business success is about having demand for your product in the future. I don't care how efficient you are today. If there's no demand for your product a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line, you're out of business. And you cannot then efficiency yourself to success. So I think that's one of the threads I worry about with AI is that if it's only about efficiency, I'd be careful about how much time I put into it. Does that efficiency dramatically matter in your business? Sometimes it does. It's not that efficiency is meaningless. It just has to be looked at strategically. You know, is it strategically important or simply easy?
Or is it just automating something that is well contained and well understood? So if you automated, you will reap the benefits and therefore go forth and automate it.
Yeah. Well, actually, in that mind, automating something can take it out of your mind as a worry. So if you're able to, as a company, you had to spend, you know, 20% of your effort in something that you can automate in a way where you're not really having to spend much effort there at all, that's a big deal for the company because now you have an extra 15% of energy to spend doing something else. Or you lose the distraction. Sometimes companies have jobs they do, or they do, you know, integrated jobs into the company that are so time consuming they really distract the company from focusing on what matters more.
Right.
Film production companies all rent out equipment. I've never been sure that that's quite a good idea because that means they have to continually be refreshing equipment. They've got to have somebody in charge of renting equipment. I mean, they have a whole nother little side business that's unrelated to how they really make money. And it might be smart and it might not be.
Right. Well, one walkaway from this for me is that you should be trying it.
Yes.
You should be experimenting. You should put a circle around the group and say, you guys go find out what it's good for. Because we kind of conceptually think we know what it's good for. But in practice, we need to know more.
I think I fully agree. I want to add one little caution that I've been a little surprised because you and I both come out of experimentation backgrounds. We know this. We do this all the time. I've been surprised by how many companies see an experiment means either they do a full-size attempt to bring it to market or they do nothing. there is so much room in between those two. I mean, experimenting can be the CEO on a weekend throwing something into a ChatGPT to just see what comes back. Experimenting could be a department where you say, hey, we want you guys to go play with ChatGPT this week and come back and tell us if you can find a way that it applies to your work. You know, and some of those little experiments are where you're going to discover, you know, either eliminate stuff that's not going to work for you or discover places that could work.
Yeah. There's also definitely a how-to for AI. Mm-hmm. You need to know how to use it properly. Mm-hmm. You need to know how to set it up, especially with agentic AI, which is like the next mini wave that is happening. Mm-hmm. How do you set them up? How do you use them? How do you manage them? Who do you make them available to? What does that mean for organizational structure? Mm-hmm. Those definitely require a best practice, so to say, this is the proper way of doing it. If you don't do it in a proper way, then it doesn't work, or worse.
Actually, along those lines, I have a question we didn't talk about in the pre-show, but I want to ask you live, which is, when you and I first started talking about this a couple of years ago, the reality was really clear at that point in time that AI should be somewhat kept for people who are experts in their field, right? Not in AI, but experts in their field, because there was always this risk of AI hallucinating something that didn't exist or getting off track. Where has that ended up? Because I feel like that still is out there, that there is still a need for somebody with serious chops in a field to review it, to say thumbs up, thumbs down, or ask questions about it. But I don't know if that's changing.
Yeah, it seems like with the emerging agent swarms, as some people call it, or like agentic as a fleet of agents, the real thing that you need to use it is good understanding of what you want. Mm-hmm. What you need, and what are the policies and business rules and actions that you need to make sure this thing delivers. So that makes you a manager of a bunch of AI agents. And if you are doing developer work, I mean, on my other podcast, my colleague Adrian has been playing around with code generation. And I asked him if that's like having interns do the coding and like junior programmers. He says, no, it's actually like expert programmers. But even expert programmers are liable to code something you didn't ask them to do. But with the agents, you can assign different personalities to each one. And one could write, the other one could clean up, the other one runs tests, the other one checks the guy who was running tests. And your role as a human becomes managing them. This was the other article that I shared with you that was talking about you're all head chefs now because you have to manage the entire thing. So in a way, that sort of also highlights the importance of managerial expertise. But that, I believe, is an interesting impact on organizational structure and who, in fact, is best placed to use it.
Yeah, actually, in a way, I'd say that confirms what we were talking about earlier, that I mean, it's a tool that you do. Somebody with real expertise can make a lot out of, potentially. But it also leaves the big social gap we saw in the last couple of weeks, which was that some recommendations came out that said, well, companies can get rid of entry-level employees. And of course, the immediate response online was, where do you think mature employees come from?
That's right. You know, that's actually a big
challenge.
You don't
get mature employees without entry-level employees. And in fact, we already have a miserable problem. Everybody I know who's looking for work right now, and in the current economy, there's a lot, is telling me that they all see these absurd requests for somebody with, you know, 5 years of experience or 10 years of experience, and they're offering a salary of $50,000 a year. Just absurd stuff. But and then if we're going to add AI in and take away all the entry-level positions, that's just going to get worse.
But let me add that, at least in the context of what I was talking about, the expertise that you need is in what the product should look like.
Right.
What problem you're trying to solve. The expertise is not in coding.
Right.
So that stuff, you could argue, that is going to revamp what coding is like in due course. Obviously, if you're writing code for heart surgery or sending, you know,
you might approach it differently.
You do need a lot more checks and balances. But we all interact with software and websites that are not even that well designed. And, you know, you put something that doesn't work and you say, okay, like maybe AI can do that. And in fact, it can do a lot more.
Well, I guess,
but my point is that the expertise that you do need entry-level people is the expertise of what we should want. So that's where entry-level jobs are going to have to go.
Right. Well, and I think, but that's going to be a problem for companies because they're not set up to find, search, groom those people, I think. It's especially bad within the marketing services worlds, you know, advertising, places like that. You know, now you have people where for them to become able to say, this is what we want, there's a long process of learning about how human beings work, what do they respond to, how do you research that to find out. You know, that stuff doesn't already exist, and therefore you really need people that, you know, fundamentally have to learn their way through that. You know, one of the unique advantages we have as humans is, yes, they call it learning for AI, but human learning is much more multidimensional, I guess I'd say. You know, human learning is much deeper and thicker, and in the long run, discovers, you know, the stuff that matters.
Yeah.
But you have to give people a way to do that learning. So even with writing code, I mean, I don't know about, let me go with just writing, because that's all I do these days. But even with just writing, I have worked a little bit with some AI generated stuff, and it drives me crazy because I need to fight the battle to figure out what word should go where if I'm going to crack the code on how to get an important idea across. And my instincts can't become informed until I fight that battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some battles we have to fight ourselves as humans, or else we'll never learn them. You know, there are some battles where it's just fine. And I don't know where you draw the distinction. You know, I can't draw that line and know where does it matter, where doesn't it. So I'm expressing that just to say there are things where we have to be the ones that fight with the words. Actually, Melanie Mitchell has observed that too. She uses AI for various things to help her out. She's an AI expert. But she, I believe, noted that she prefers to do her own writing throughout because it's the only way you fight with the words to figure out how to tease out something that really matters.
I think writing, if we just focus on writing as a subset of content creation, I think writing is such a personal thing that if you can use AI to help your process for writing, then that's good enough as long as the result is authentic and it is what you want and it like helped you in the process. Now, I have tested it out too, like everybody else has. And what probably would work for me is what has worked for me all along, which is that if I get a first draft from someone, suddenly I can just be productive. And, you know, and it's not just editorial. I may like rewrite the whole thing, but it is much faster for me to rewrite the whole thing than to write it from the beginning. I do that. I could do that. Occasionally I do that. But it is, in fact, faster if I have a first draft from somewhere. So does AI help me with that? I think it can. Now, you know, as it happens, podcasts are a lot easier for me than writing. So that's what we're doing.
I agree with that, man. When I have to write something, I'm like, really? Oh, you know, that means I really have to think it through and, you know, figure out that translation from what we can discuss that's vital and interesting and all that stuff into great. How do I write it so that it's vital and interesting and all that stuff?
Right, right. Also, what write about these days requires a lot of iterations to get the structure right. Because oftentimes it is a complex topic for me and I need to just go around the block many, many times.
Well, and I'm going to point with AI, some stuff that's kind of like really new. And boy, I haven't been pleased with what I've seen because it depends. AI is a backward look and that's not a problem. It's just something we need to know about. So to explore a topic that hasn't been explored, I also was disappointed. I was kind of angry with AI the other day. I put in a topic I'd written about, and I put the topic in there with my name, and the AI on Google came back and said, there's no Garnett anywhere around that topic. So not that I took it personally, but...
Well, maybe it's trying to appropriate it for its own.
Oh, that's why that next sentence said, but if Garnett was to write about it, here's what he'd say.
Right.
I should briefly give, because I can make a little more detail on the book. So yes, I'm writing about complexity and Columbia University will be publishing the book. So
brilliant.
Sometime next year, I expect, although nobody has said this is the date. So all I can say is I expect that. I'm finishing up. I have a due date to deliver it to them. And I can't announce anything bigger like titles and the like, but it's fundamentally the whole book is about how does complexity affect how we should view our roles as managers? How should we manage companies given our understanding of complexity that's come out of science?
Well, I think it's very timely because we do live in an age of complexity.
Yeah. Well, I think you and I were talking about that a little bit. And I think to some degree, companies were able to get away without worrying about it for a lot of years. And I don't know what you call it. There's enough fluff in the system that they were able to survive. But I think a lot of that has tightened up. I think it's also become far more difficult with the degree to which every company has to think worldwide. Because
I just think there's a lot more complexity. You know, it's not like complexity didn't exist.
Right.
And it, of course, by definition does. Mm-hmm. But I just think that it's in overdrive right now.
Well, yeah, like, I guess maybe I'd say is that we're more deeply in touch with it because it affects us every day. I mean, you know, I mean, one place that has always been complex is that you go to another culture and you have a whole lot of complexity attempting to understand how to thrive around that other culture. Yeah, well, we do that every day on Zoom calls now. You know, it used to be once a year you took a trip to India or you took a trip to China. And now there's a lot of people that spend their entire life doing nothing but that.
That's right. That's right. Know. We also talked in our previous conversation about the importance of learning. And if there are so many things you need to be learning, it takes time out of other things. So that's a change in how one must approach life. And it also makes it difficult.
Absolutely. I mean, and AI being the big one that's on everybody's minds right now. I think what's hard for learning these days in a practical way, this is not so much out of complexity science, but in a practical way, is deciding when that learning matters and when it doesn't. You know, I've seen a lot of things about how anybody who's looking for a job needs to become thoroughly sophisticated with AI. And I'd say, yeah, that's not going to be a successful path for everybody. So I think everybody should have some familiarity with AI. But, you know, to suddenly demand, as I see various learning sites online do, that everybody be an AI expert, now that's not even realistic. You know, so we've got to find smarter ways to thrive.
No, and even after you've done that, you may or may not.
Well, and in fact, you know, a friend of mine said the other day, the AI is changing so fast that, you know, wait 2 months and your learning is out of date.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's, you know, we've seen this problem time after time. I always come back to, you know, fundamentally the most important thing to do through one's schooling, you know, all the way from, you know, elementary through college is to learn how to learn.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
You cannot predict what you're going to need to know in 10 years or 15 years.
That's right. That's right.
You know, so if you're adaptable enough to learn something new as it comes up, that's the single most important thing in life is being able to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a blog on this at some point. It was more in the context of mentorship, but I think part of it was skill set, mindset, knowing how you learn, and did anybody notice? Those were the four things. Are you learning about your mindset? Are you learning new skills? How you carry yourself, what you know how to do?
Yeah.
But then to do that, you need to know whether you best learn by doing, by reading, by looking over somebody's shoulders, by whatever it is that you need. So it would be good to know that. And then it would be good if after you learned everything, you could somehow demonstrate it. We should talk a little bit about CMOs. Maybe that's the topic to close on.
Sure. I'm down with that. So there was an article in Adweek about CMOs that piqued our interest that said that the CMO title, Chief Marketing Officer title, is becoming less popular, and just 40% of Fortune 500 marketers have that, or companies have their top marketer with that title. Other titles are Chief Revenue Officer, Chief Growth Officer. Do we get to add a Chief BS Officer? Never mind. are becoming more common as the CMO role evolves to encompass broader responsibilities. Now, I couldn't read, it was paywall protected, so all I could do is read kind of the top stuff and, you know, on that article. I think there's a lot to discuss, as we have, about CMOs.
And there have been several other articles that have been touching on CMO as a title, as a function, as a whatever. And one of the few times I did write, it was about how marketing is such a difficult job. And it actually ended with a reference to Regis McKenna's article about marketing being everything. And if it is everything, then it is a very difficult job. So my feeling is that maybe what's happening is that companies are not hiring chief marketing officers who can actually do the job. And then instead of hiring people who can do the job, they change the title.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of that. I mean, one of the articles that you and I looked at, I hadn't noticed it when we looked at it yesterday, but it suggests that we move from chief marketing officer to chief value officer. And my stomach turned as I read that. Because as a marketing, teaching marketing, I really dislike the way that a lot of marketing books just say, well, it's all about creating value. What a vague, indefinite, unknown term to try to get students to embrace. You know, no, we're still in business to make profit. And, you know.
But also the problem isn't the title. The problem is, I mean, the reason why it became a topic is because CMOs need to have a proverbial seat at the table in the C-suite. Well, if you're attending a C-suite, what value are you adding to that meeting?
Yeah, you have to be able to really engage with those topics.
If you are running sales, or you're the chief revenue officer, so to say, then you can talk about revenue. You can talk about customers. You can talk about your pipeline. You can talk about what you're learning from customers. So that's like serious value add, and that's why they always have a seat at the table.
Right, if but on chief, the other hand, I mean, I have found that people with a chief revenue officer, does that really, though, engage with the full board strategic topic of how should the, you know, the integrates manufacturing and engineering and all that stuff along with it?
Well, it may not, but it will for the 20 minutes when you're talking about sales.
Right.
Right? Because right. people want to know from the guy who's running sales.
And, yeah, and I guess I'm responding a little bit from when I was in, you know, in marketing, moved from sales to marketing and started going out in the field. And I realized that when I talked to salespeople and said, well, what should we do with the product? Their single answer was whatever lost them the most recent sale. And so I ended up missing a long-term sense. And it's not that chief revenue officer is the wrong idea. I just think there is danger in it becoming, you know,
but that's kind of what I'm saying, that it's not the title. It's like, what value do you add at that meeting?
Absolutely.
And there are heads of sales and chief revenue officers who are absolutely awesome. And they really know and, you know, et cetera. And if you're the CEO, of course you add value that way. So now the question is, does the head of marketing add value?
Right.
Well, and if you know about the market, if you know about the technology, if you know about the supply chain, competitive situation, buying behavior, mega trends in the market, the legal aspects of your brand and IP, and it's a really tall order. But if you actually do know about all of that, and if you can add value when the topic comes up, then I believe the answer is absolutely. And not only that, there's like a need for it, a hunger for it. Well, so the question is, are you hiring people who know how to do that?
Well, I think that's really the key to it. I think a lot of people are looking at chief marketing officers as chief advertising officers. And all of a sudden, they lose all that value. If all you expect is somebody that is in marketing deals with the one P, which is promotion, you know, they're not marketers. That's a promotion person. And that's not
that's
wrong.
That's right. Exactly.
But it's not a marketer overall. And I think we've lost that. As you and I have talked, there is some challenge that we are talking about CMO who, you know, their next step is to become CEO at some level. You know, that's kind of that they're, to be a real CMO, you should have that level of understanding and comprehension, you know, and that could be, you know, in some companies, that's not going to be okay with a CEO. In a lot of companies, it should be because,
well, you know, ideal scenario is that you have, I mean, the ideal scenario in a high performance company is that the CEO staff are all capable of doing the job, but the team is together and nobody's competing for it and everybody's happy with what they're doing. The CEO has a very unique role that you need someone to go play that isn't marketing, that isn't sales. And if you have the right person doing that, then it's very clear that they are adding massive value, right?
Well, and I guess with that, then, if you have the right CMO, the marketing officer will argue from the point of view of marketing, right? I mean, you want them to represent the area they stand for. And to, you know, as great CEO would want to have strong CMOs, strong engineering, strong manufacturing, strong finance, and allow them all to freely argue with each other and listen and engage. And that, figure out what matters.
Exactly.
I think that's rarer than it should be, but that's really the ideal.
Yeah. Both you and I have had personal experience across that spectrum, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I have personal experience working with absolutely fantastic CEOs mm-hmm. who just play the role as well as it can be played. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to get the best out of everybody on the team. Mm-hmm. And everybody on the team is competent and good, and it all works well together. And then, of course, you have the other end of the spectrum where the, you know, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess what we're really saying is, damn it, let's make CMO a really robust role, but let's make sure we hire people who are up to it.
Exactly. Don't hire a weak person and then complain about the title. You could do that about anybody. You could say that, you know, the chief engineer is like no longer in vogue because the last 10 we hired are not engineers. Well, you know.
It's true, but I think marketing is one of those areas that somehow the companies have lost clarity on what marketing positions essentially should be. You know, I argue with my class that rather than the four Ps, I start them with what I call the three roles and then get to the four Ps. And the roles are understand the market, bring that understanding to the company, and oh, by the way, they have some things they do, like in charge of promotions. Most companies tend to see marketing through what they do, advertising, and ignore the fact that they really are supposed to know the market well. And so if you want to be robust as a marketer, you got to start with know the market, understand what's going on in the market, know it inside and out. And then that's incredible value for the company. But yeah, companies want them to go do.
You really got to know all of the above. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what makes it hard.
Absolutely.
Like, knowing the market is just the first step, mm-hmm. right? Then you have to know the product. You have to know the competition. You have to know all of that.
Actually, say market, I include all that with it.
The four Ps are embedded in it. Yeah.
They're embedded in it. Well, and the four Ps then become our levers, you know, they're mm-hmm. the things that we're able to use. So once we know all that, then we turn to the four Ps to say, okay, I got to make something happen because this problem's emerging in the market, or there's a cool opportunity. How do I use the four Ps to get there?
And that's right. So in fact, one thing that does make marketing interesting as a profession mm-hmm. is that it is everything.
It is everything.
Yep. Right? So if you really want to master it all and that's what excites you, mm-hmm. marketing is for you because it is also endless. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful to have your arms around all that expansive thing.
That's true. It is one of the few places in a corporation where you can really engage the whole of the doing business. You end up having to touch every part of doing business. Not that you're responsible for it, but you end up having to know about everything.
You truly do. And if you do, then you can kind of perform a really good job, and it's a tall order. Now, as it relates to like hiring, it reminds me of the advice I've been giving to all my CEO friends or whoever asks me, is that you need to take marketing as seriously as you take engineering. Mm-hmm. And the example I give is that just like you don't hire an engineering intern and expect, you know, mm-hmm. a product at the end of summer, mm-hmm. you cannot hire a marketing intern and expect marketing. Mm-hmm. Marketing has come a long way. It's highly technical. It's arts plus sciences. Mm-hmm. It's the technology stack. It is spending a lot of money on IT, in fact. It's like data. We have that other article we didn't get to about the complexity of marketing data, which we have talked about a lot in this mm-hmm. podcast. It's all of the above. You've got to take it seriously. And if you do take it seriously, then you need to spend money on it and need to go hire the right people. Mm-hmm. And you realize that if it is as important as engineering, then it's going to cost as much mm-hmm. and you have to like incorporate it the same way.
Yeah, you have to treat it that seriously. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And if you do, you'll reap the benefits. Mm-hmm. But if you think it's a gumball machine, to use the analogy you've used here a few times, mm-hmm. then you say, oh, here's my, you know, mm-hmm. $10, what am I going to get for it mm-hmm. like next week? And the answer is probably nothing. Mm-hmm. Right? If that's your perspective, then maybe mm-hmm. you're not ready for marketing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right. On that happy note.
On that happy note, I'm going to put my flak jacket on and go out and get coffee.
All right. Happy Halloween. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for being with us. And until next time, thank you, Doug.
Thank you, Shuhi.
That's it for this episode of the Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.